for a new chair.
Come on, Tyson Binky! Give this pontoon a push, eh? Come on, it's Bill and Mike! We gotta go back!
Hook him with your pole and reel him in.
I don't know what 20 upers in a pontoon boat has to do with anything. Can you imagine chasing alligator walleye pike? That's the Die Upers. Go to dieupers.com. Tell them Fish and Frank said hey. Anyway, enough of that. Fish and Frank here. And we are... we're not exactly live in the radio, but we're not exactly dead. But we're here somewhere on the radio, and Robert's in the chair across from me. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Frank.
Captain Morris Campbell.
Hey, Frank.
And Captain Carl Buttigieg.
Hello.
Don't you just... I like saying his last name, Buttigieg. I don't know if it sounds like dirty or if it sounds like you're having fun. You know, I don't know.
Maybe a combination of the two.
Yeah, it kind of sounds naughty. You know, like there should be some kind of slang term for something, Buttigieg. You know, like, and look at that girl, Buttigieg. You know?
Uh-oh. No, I don't know about that.
I'm sorry, I can't help myself. All right, anyway, that just means she's an intelligent, well-educated woman. That was what that meant.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Anyway, get me out of this, guys. Today we're going to talk about trolling. Trolling. The act of putting something behind the boat and dragging it along, not Robert.
Okay.
Okay.
Depends on the day.
Yeah, well, there are days.
I'm sure there are certain
days.
Well,
he makes way too much noise when you put him back there, so you have to bring him back in.
It's the kicking's not bad, but the screaming is kind of what gets you after a while. Yeah. All right. Trolling. Trolling can be done live with live bait of some sort. Trolling can be done with artificial lures, can be done with dead bait, pieces of bait. It can be done in fresh water, can be done in salt water. You can do it in the Atlantic, the Gulf, the Pacific, any kind of big deep body of water. And you can also do it in the tiniest of creeks. Pretty much anywhere. I actually go trolling on some of the piers when I'm going out looking for different fish. I'll put a lure on a rod, cast it out, and just walk along pulling the lure, kind of shaking it every once in a while, which I'm the boat, the lure's being pulled behind me. It's still trolling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you could troll. I guess you could actually go swimming and troll a lure behind you.
Sure.
Why not, right? As any
guys do it paddleboarding nowadays.
Yeah, paddleboarding's a big thing with that.
Let's don't do that in fresh water, though, because you're double trolling when you do that.
Well,
we got walleye, pike, alligators instead of the reverse.
Yeah, we have we're down and we're broadcasting from downtown Charlotte Harbor, Florida, a real place that doesn't exist anymore, but it does to us because we're here. Anyway, let's see. So we've ascertained you can go pretty much trolling anywhere. Anybody got a favorite style of trolling? Anybody want to start off?
I do not.
Not a favorite style?
No.
Carl, you got a favorite style of trolling?
I mean, not really. I mean, I like trolling the canals.
What's your favorite thing to troll for?
Probably snook.
Snook? Morris, what's your favorite thing to troll for?
Blue marlin.
Blue marlin. Mm-hmm. Robert?
I would say snook is going to be the most practical one for me.
Okay, because inshore you live on a canal, so...
Yeah.
All right. You know, Carl, I was kind of surprised at your answer. I would have thought it had been cobia and tarpon, because you troll for them a lot. But it's not your favorite fish to troll for.
Yes and no. I mean, I like them in the canals, because when you hook up on a big snook, it's like you got to get that fish turned, because if not, he's going to get you in the docks.
More
challenging. A little more exciting, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I actually like trolling next to bridges. The wooden, you know, they have the safety wooden bumpers in between the big bridges, and the boats are supposed to pass through there. I love trolling those. To me, that's sheer excitement. It's right on point and everything. But let's get a little open water stuff here and kind of get a feel for how you go trolling. Morris, live bait, dead bait?
Yeah, all the above.
All the lures.
All the above. You can start, you know, coastal, you know, from just off the shoreline out to 60 feet, I would say, 70 feet. And you can troll live baits. When you're trolling live bait, it's a slow troll situation.
Now, with what you were saying about 60, 70 feet, I know a lot of people trolling real, real deep water, thousands of feet.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you bring up 60 out to 60, 70?
Well, over the last almost 30 years, I've caught a whole lot of sailfish and pelagic species inside of 60 feet trolling. Biggest majority of those I caught live bait fishing, slow trolling Spanish sardines, blue runners, cigar minnows, thread herrings, big white baits. You know, most of the time the targeted fish would be king mackerel, which we have a whole lot of at times of the year. And, you know,
so from the shoreline out 60, 70 feet is a personal preference, but not a limitation.
Not a limitation. You can slow troll live bait in 1,000 feet of water if you like, or anywhere in between, or anywhere past that.
All right, Robert, you anything about the trolling out there?
Well, and I think one thing that people need to understand, like in Southwest Florida, or basically the west coast of Florida for the most part, it's pretty shallow. So even 60 feet, you're out, what, 12 miles, 13 miles,
yeah.
You know, so for us, it's almost a normal thing to do,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's not the stereotypical, we're going to be speed trolling with big skirts and hundreds of feet of water looking for wahoo. Our species are going to be more limited for the most part overall.
Yeah.
But it's way underutilized because, like you said, sailfish. I've seen plenty of sailfish in 30 feet of water.
Yes. They're
out looking for tarpon. You know, so it's pretty wild the amount of stuff that we do have around here. So
all right.
I like that shallower water.
All right. Is, if you're in the Atlantic, is it going to be a feet thing or miles offshore thing?
It's more of a feet thing in the Atlantic because, say off the East Coast, say we're in Palm Beach area or Fort Lauderdale, basically all of your fish are concentrated on that drop off there that's maybe a mile or two off the beach. You know, it's mainly a 90 to 120 foot drop off.
90 to 120 foot?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then it also depends on where the Loop Current or Gulf Stream might
come. Yeah, your continental shelf literally there falls off to really deep water, say 600, 1,000 feet of water within a few miles of the shoreline. Whereas on our side, it's about 80 miles off before our continental shelf starts to go away and it really starts to drop off. That being said, there's no safety net out there in the deep water that keeps those pelagic species that we're talking about, for the most part, nothing keeps them from coming into shallow water, you know, except water temperature. And,
right.
And then when the water temperatures are above 70 degrees, you're going to get all of those things. You know, they'll come in to where bait's at, and we're normally loaded with bait. So don't be surprised when you encounter one of those so-called deep water species in 40, 60 feet of water.
All right. Now, when I do a setup, I like trolling lures, and I used to troll a lot of spoons. But as I've gotten older, spoons are kind of a pain. If I'm using a planer or a downrigger, something... Well, not a downrigger, because downriggers I got to go too slow. But when I'm trolling in salt water and I try and use a spoon, if I can put it behind a planer and your line attaches to the planer, then you have a separate line going back to the bait. I usually go from the back of my planer about 12 feet, maybe even 14. But I put a ball bearing swivel on, and that can twist the heck out of that line. It really doesn't matter. But when I put a spoon off my regular rod, even with a ball bearing swivel, I get so much twist. So what I've tended to do is going with lures with a lip on it. I start off in the back of the boat with my deepest lure. Let's say something is going to dive down about 40 feet, back right corner. I go in the back left corner, and I'm going to something that's going to go to about 20 feet. Then I go midship, right-hand side, something that's going to be like, say, 6 to 10 feet under. And then on the mid side, on the left side, I go with something either at or near the surface. Now, if I have my preferences, which I do usually, I'll come up the middle of it with something little tiny. And as that first one, it's my deepest one. It's also closest to the boat. The one on the back left is going to be a little bit shallower and a little further back. The midship right, that one's going to be a little shallower and even farther back than the second one. And the midship's left, that one is going to be the farthest one back and very shallow. And then if I put my little one out, the reason I want that little one the furthest back is most of the time with a smaller lure, it takes a lot more line out to keep it in the water at all. And these are lures that are anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5 inches long. That's my snack factor. That's where I get my most activity, sometimes even my biggest fish, on these little tiny, tiny lures that are kind of like an anchovy or glass minnow size, something 2.5 inches, 3 to 3.5 inches long, a little tiny one. Now, those are my favorite setups, all with lures with a lip on them. They're all depth specific, like a Rapala or some of the other ones. Now, I used to use a lot of Manns, but the problem I have with the Manns lure is you got to put it in the water, see if it's going to pull to the left or to the right, and then you got to put it on that side of the boat. Because if it's pulling to the left and you got it on the right-hand side, it's going to go into your other lures. But if it's pulling to the left, you put it on the left-hand side of the boat, it will go outside and won't tear up anything. But I like them stacked so the very deepest is closest to the boat, and then they get shallower as they get further away and further away. So what's your kind of trolling setup, Morris? Are you a spoon guy? Or
it all depends on where and how. There are several different setups I'll use. One of the main things that I do is I'll take, you know, say we're in 60, 70 feet of water and I'm trolling. If I'm on a small boat, I would run 2 outrigger baits. If you don't have outriggers, you can still put a release clip of some kind on your hard top or even on the transom of your boat. But I'll run 2 top baits, usually with a ballyhoo on them and some sort of skirt. You know, color is, you know, can be any color you want to put back there. I'll run 2 of those, one a little bit deeper than the other, and they'll be the farthest baits back. And then I would come in and run a Rapala, the X-Rap 30. The reason I recommend that particular one is that it doesn't break out if you're going 7 mile an hour. The Manns and the Bombers, when you troll them 7 mile an hour, they're going to flip out of the water and skip out.
It's surprising that there's a big difference in how the lures are made.
Yeah.
And some of the lures are just fine, but like I said, with the Manns, I can't get them this track straight. And
the Yozeris don't track straight either at that speed. And
yeah.
They advertise them to 2, but they don't do that. The Manns and the new the new one you've gotten in the shop lately, the new diving plug with the single hooks on it.
Oh, that's the Rapala.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a different manufacturer.
Normar?
It starts with a P. It's that new one from Ray that we just kind of
It's got the single hooks on it. That thing tracks at 8-9 mile an hour perfectly.
Yeah, I can't remember the name.
It's well balanced. It's well designed.
It's an Australian made lure. That much I do know.
Yeah, I can picture the package. I just can't picture the name.
Those lures are usually ran. I'll usually put some sort of diving lure flat, either side. It doesn't really matter which side. And then I would take a standard Bomber. The big 2-hook model, the largest one that they make without the deep bill, and I would put one of those on the other side of it, and you know, as just a basic trolling setup, that works fine. And for something deep, I would put a cedar plug in either pink and white, blue and white, or purple black, and put it right behind everything, probably 20-30 yards behind everything. And that's a simple setup to troll around and catch. You can catch everything from sailfish to little tunies and king mackerel and, you know, anything that's up. If you go over a piece of structure and there are amberjacks there, don't be surprised if you hit a double or triple header amberjack on that.
Okay. Carl, let's pretend you're out in the Gulf. You got a trolling situation going on. What kind of setup do you like to use?
Well, I've never been big into like the outriggers and stuff like that. I've never had them on any of my boats. Typically, what I like to do is I troll 2 rods. I like to keep it simple. No too much of a mess going on in the back of the boat. I usually do like a Bomber for the shallow, and then I usually go like a bigger X-Rap, you know, to get a little bit deeper. When I troll, you know, most of the time we're going for those two thick critters, so I like to use this AFW, the tieable steel eater. I like to use a 90 pound, you know, just because kings, they got some pretty good teeth and stuff. Thing about trolling, what I do is I troll a lot slower than everybody else. I look at it as, like, if I was out there, if I was a fish, I'm going to be lazy, and I'm not going to go chase something coming by the boat, you know, going by me really fast. I'm going to wait for something slow.
Normally, I would say, okay, if you meet Carl on land, he's kind of like about a mile and a half an hour guy. He's going along, okay, I got to do this. And what I don't get, because as soon as he gets in the water, he's like 200 miles an hour. You're out there, you're fishing with, and all of a sudden he's on top of the T-top. He's back down. He's looking for fish. He's in the water. He's moving the boat back. He's going over here, going over there. And then he gets off land, gets on land. And he goes, okay, I'm ready to go. All right. And yet when you're out of the water, you're thinking a fish is moving slow.
Yeah.
It's like it's nothing even to do with your nature.
It's easier prey. I don't want to work hard for my food. I want my food brought to me.
Okay, now we're getting it. Yeah, you're always a drive-through guy. You're never a walk-in guy.
Yeah, well, no, I walk in, but I want it brought to me. I don't want to get up and go to the buffet a bunch of times.
And what he's saying has a lot of merit, because the lures of his choice are diving crankbaits, basically. And, you know, you can fish them fast, and some of the ones that you can choose, you can fish way too fast. So, say the bomber or the mans, you're going to need to run at it 3 or 4 mile an hour. So that's slow.
Tops.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're maxing out on those once you hit about 4 miles an hour. So that 2 mile an hour that Carl's talking about actually has a lot of merit to it.
It does.
With those kind of plugs. So, and we know you catch fish, Carl. We're never sure how, but we know you catch fish.
Yeah, but, you know, I just look at it as if I'm a fish. I want the food brought to me. I want something that's wounded or easier prey than something that's 100% going through the water 100 miles an hour.
Okay. So Carl's into fish prefer to be lazy. They want to relax. The food comes across.
Well, it's like when a big pot of bait, if a fish sees a wounded fish, they're going to single that one out, you know, because it's a lot easier to prey. So, I mean, that's just the way I look. You know, that's me.
All right. No, all good. Valid points.
It is.
All right, Robert. You're here. What are you cashing on your trolling thing? You got anything that you like to put out, spreads?
Usually I'm going to run 3 different depths of lures. I don't get carried away with 4 is a little too much for me. 2's just not quite enough, so I'll just stick right in the middle. And I'm with you in the aspect of that I'm going to use 1 depth specific lure is going to be the closest one, the deepest runner, whether it's a Rapala or something put on a planer, depending on the size of the planer. And then I'm usually going to troll like either a fairly shallow running lure, kind of mid-distance behind the boat. You know, let's say 100 feet, I'm going to troll a Rapala X-Rap, something that's going to dive down 4 to 6 feet, you know, like a size 10 or maybe even a number 12. Depends. And then, of course, out the back, I'm going to do 1 of 2 lures. It's going to be the farthest out and the shallowest runner. And it's either going to be a unpainted 4-inch cedar plug or the small skirted bait, something like a Sea Witch, or one of the CNHs, just a pre-rigged little skirted, I don't know what I would call it, smoker bait or just a little
bubble heads and stuff,
bubble
like
heads, stuff like that. Something that's going to be in that 4 to 5-inch length range. And that's going to be the farthest one out the back of the boat. And that way I've got all the sizes kind of covered and the different depths, because I'm usually very seldom running out past, you know, 60 feet of water with most of the people I go fishing with. And we've caught everything, cudas, kings, dolphin, you know, seen plenty of, you know, a handful of sails. I'm not going to say plenty because I don't have your experience out there offshore like you guys have. But I've seen plenty of them out there. And
Carl, have you done sailfish?
I've seen them, and I wasn't prepared when I seen them.
Okay.
Yep.
So
I was grabbing everything in the boat, but I knew nothing was in the boat was going to work, but I was still trying it.
All right. So
the biggest thing I'm going to have...
You got you and Carl, me and Morris. So
right.
It might switch the other way around, but that's okay, young one. We will endeavor to
the one thing I am going to have still, like you said earlier, is a ball bearing snap swivel. I'm going to have that attached to all of my lures.
Anything.
Everything that's out there, whether it's made to track straight or twist and turn like a spoon will, but also because I like to change things up a little bit. I'm going to experiment. You've taught me never to just try to stay with the same thing over and over again. And hearing some of Morris's stories, there are times where some of those pelagic fish are very picky about colors and sizes. You know, I'm going to stick with the traditional colors that are usually good, like the pink and purple, or the dolphin colors are pretty much your kind of two go-to colors. But every now and then, I'm like, okay, nothing's happening. I'm going to switch to the black and purple, which is generally a much better color in deeper, deeper water.
It's one of the top colors in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. I also know in the world it's one of the best colors.
Worldwide, yes.
You know, so that there's going to be times where I'm just going to say change it out. Like this eater plug's not getting any action. I might switch it over just to a 1 ounce, you know, Johnson Sprite or Silver Minnow, you know, which is a single hook lure. Or a Clark spoon, something like that, but I'm going to go, you know, downsize it in some way, shape, or form just to see what's happening and why I'm not getting these hits.
All right, here's something, and they were talking about black and purple. Now, black and purple is one of those colors that if you do any fishing, you probably don't notice it. But boy, once you get out there and you start trolling and you're looking for mahi or sailfish or pretty much any of your offshore stuff, you better learn black and purple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of those, it's that thing that if you're fishing on the flats, you don't have black and purple lures. Bass fishermen, a bit more.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Even them, they're kind of getting away from the black and purple, going with a lot of these funky colors. But for years, it was a bass catching staple. And nowadays, it's faded a little bit. It's not in fashion. But black and purple, you better get to know if you're going to be in the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic or the Pacific.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on that. And I don't know if it's because of the contrast, because most of your predatory, most of your pelagic fish are coming from the bottom up. So does the black and purple stand out a little bit more?
Yeah, they've done a lot of
backlighting of it.
They've done a lot of research on the billfish. And the mahi, because they can actually keep the mahis in captivity and do some studies on them. And they tend to see more of the blues, purples, and the darker colors. Their eyes, that's what they focus in on because they're looking at that silhouette.
Back in the 1960s and early 70s, Berkeley Bedot, that's the guy's name, that's why it's called Berkeley Bates, is because that's his first name. He spent a lot of money in Iowa and at their home base looking, researching fish. And the University of Wisconsin and a few other ones did a lot of research. Blue is the most visible color to freshwater fish. And from what you're telling me, blue's in the top visible colors for saltwater fish.
Yes, the blues and the purples and things like that.
So blue in freshwater, number one color fish see first. They notice blue before anything, which is kind of weird.
See, and I don't know if I agree with that part of it in the saltwater fish.
It is, though.
Blue.
Yeah. Blues and purples.
The purples I could see. The blues I don't, because, I mean, I know a lot of your, and this is my only reasoning, so bear with me for a second, is that all of your pelagic fish out there swimming normally without being fired up from being caught are more of a darker blue color. Like, in particular, let's pick on wahoo, kings, and sailfish. They're a much dark blue, navy blue to a lighter shade of blue, but not like a black or a purple color. Only when they get fired up do they get those colors enhancement. And like wahoo, I know, are blue with that banding on them because they actually suspend down there in that 80 to 100 feet of water where all of your other colors disappear except for your blue rays of the UV color spectrum. So they actually disappear in that water column a little easier to be a better predator. They use that bending of the light for camouflage.
The stripes help there too.
That's what I'm talking about. The stripes and the blue color help bend that around them. So it's just, I know that dolphin works really well because it's worldwide one of the most abundant fish.
Well, there's a fish that you're missing that's even more abundant than the dolphin, and in areas where this fish is present, that's blue and white, and especially the Hawaiian eye, and something that would mimic that fish when it's actually swimming. the blue color is comes into play. And if you've ever had a live one in the boat with you and examined it, it's bright blue.
Flying fish.
It's a flying fish.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
And it's almost a worldwide fish, and right. especially for pelagic predators.
We right. have flying fish here in the Gulf of Mexico.
We have them almost in the past when the red tide's not there.
Right. I mean, I've gone out. One of my favorite things being offshore is watching schools of flying fish just take off and, you know, pretend I'm flying. Bam! Down in the, I mean, you talk about one of those speedboat crashes. Yeah, going along, and all of a sudden the back comes up, the nose goes in, and over they go. You would think that a fish that's literally going to one day fly, is why it doesn't learn to land. I mean, half the time the nose dips in and they go butt over tea kettle all the way across the surface of the water and they go back swimming. Sometimes it's that gorgeous what in, but sometimes it just boom and over they go, wipe it out.
I love watching. There's another fish out there too that does something really similar, and this is why we try to troll at, you know, when we're pulling these baits, we troll them at 6.5 to almost 8 mile an hour. And it's the ballyhoo. And a lot of people will see ballyhoos go across the surface of the water on their tail, and they're just hightailing it right across the surface at high rate of speed. And people that fish with me almost inevitably come up and say, well, why are we trolling so fast? Look at the baits. They're skipping along the top of the water. And I said, that's because that's what an excited ballyhoo that's being chased looks like, and that stimulates that predator's, you know, instinct to attack and catch that ballyhoo that's in trouble.
So, basic differences here. Morris is going out trying to entice a bite by acting like a very excited, scared fish that's darting across the water, trying to escape a predator. And Carl's going after him, going, okay, man. Yeah, man, you got this here. I give you a sandwich.
It's the Jamaican here, marlin.
You just... You come along here, you eat my fish, man. Okay, soon come. You know, so you got, yeehaw, we're going after him. And, yeah, man, soon come. So, anyway, a lot of different styles, a lot of different techniques. One of the things, some companies come out with quite a bit of different trolling stuff, but a lot of lures may or may not go down as deep. Now, there are a lot of different techniques for getting lures deeper. One of the things I want to talk about, explain here, not talk about, but explain quickly. Pelagic fish, or pelagic, whatever, however you want to pronounce it, means fish like king mackerel, Spanish mackerel, cobia. These are fish that travel all the time. They don't have a home. They go from one spot to the next, literally hobos of the sea. How's that for an old reference? Mm-hmm. But they travel along like hobos on a train. They're here one day, the next day they're north, the next day they're south. They move all the time. And these pelagic, they're roaming fish. And they don't have homes. They like to stop at reefs. But it's a stopover like you'd stop at a truck stop or a campground. They go in there, they eat, they are there for a little while, and then they move on. And best ways to find them is to look from one major structure to the next, because a lot of times that's the way they're going to travel, from one wreck to another wreck, a reef to a wreck, a reef to a reef. Finding them in between these areas gives you a great place to start trolling. Now, when you're trolling to get depth, planers, if you live up in the Great Lakes, a planer is something that takes the lure out to the side of a boat. Once you get into the south and the salt water, we're pulling a little faster because they up north use downriggers and downrigger balls to get the lures down low. They use planers to take them out to the side. We're traveling a little too fast for that a lot of times. The planer balls start to swing. The side planers, they can't handle that much speed, so they get all messed up. So in saltwater, faster trolling situations, we use outriggers, which is a long pole out the side of the boat to reach out farther, increase the width of your trolling spread. And then we use a planer, which is a flat piece of metal with a lead, and when it's set, it will take the lure down, much like the bill of a lure does on its own. It's just another way of getting more of that. When the fish hits, it's pulled, and it becomes straight, and it's only a bit of weight. It does not bring the fish to the surface, does not take them down deeper. it may actually help them get them up to the top, but you have anywhere from 2 to 4 ounces of lead on one of those, so it's holding them down a little bit. But it becomes kind of inert once the fish hits. It trips, and it pulls it straight. It's no longer down at an angle, so it no longer pulls the lure down. It doesn't have any more pressure. But there's different types of trolling weights. We have ball-bearing swivels versus regular swivels. Trolling weights are a bit of something that I like to use. But I'm kind of a weirdo because I put my line on when I'm going to put a trolling swivel sinker on. A trolling sinker is usually a torpedo-shaped lead. Has a loop at one end and a loop on the back end. I clip the front on with a ball-bearing snap swivel. Then I put the leader off the back of that trolling swivel. And all that swivel does is get you down in the water farther. A little more lead, so a lure with a lip on it that might normally go, say, 6 foot, you might be able to get it down to 10 to 20 feet. Any of you guys use sinkers when you're trolling? Like
I have with you.
I sometimes just put an egg sinker on the line and tie my leader on and use that as a trolling sinker as well.
Right.
Morris, are you big into sinkers on your lures?
Well, yeah, when we're in the Bahamas and we're just specifically targeting wahoo, we'll run two baits and we'll run literally run a pound trolling weight on each side. And we'll run...
How far down are you trying to get with a pound of lead?
It's at the speed we're trolling for wahoo, it's only going to be down about 10 feet. But literally, we're running big lures that won't go down 10 feet without the lead. And, you know, the diving lures aren't really applicable on that because we're running at anywhere from 10 to 14 mile an hour.
So you're taking a skirted lure and putting a bunch of lead in front of it to drag it down below the water, which normally it would kind of dance around right by the top.
Yes. Same lure, just down below the surface. And we're using, you know, heavy mono back to a snap swivel off of that, and then going with a cable leader, really strong, like a 300-pound cable.
And you use a cable leader for wahoo because it actually holds up better than the single
strand.
Yeah,
the single strand. I've had wahoos bite through 180, 200-pound wire, just bite right through it like it was butter.
Yeah.
Well, the reason they can bite through it is because once it's kinked, and the teeth on those fish can actually kink the wire, put a 90-degree or more bend in it, and then when it's straightened out and the fish goes side to side, if you've ever had a take a paper clip in your hand and straighten it out and then fold one end back and forth, and what you're going to find is that that paper clip just snaps in half. And that's what you're finding with these single strand wire. That fish can kink it, and then all of a sudden it's straightened out, kink, straighten out, and boom. Now you've got a broken wire.
That being said, let's talk a little bit about that wire, Frank, because when I'm fishing saltwater fish and I'm using a wire leader and we're trolling and we're apt to catch a fish that jumps, I keep my leaders less than 2 feet long for those. And a lot of times it's about 18 inches long. And that, you just explain the reason in detail there, because a jumping fish that cartwheels and goes wild and crazy on a wire leader will kink it.
Oh, I'm with you.
The shorter the wire, the less chance of having a kink.
It's going to take a megalodon to bite over the lure 2 feet. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason you have the steel on there is in case the fish hits it head on where he's going to bite into your leader and the lure. But pretty much no fish are going to bite 24 inches past the lure.
Correct.
You've only need about 12, 18 inches of steel there. And then anything else is just strictly for your fingers. Because single strand leader, I still think you get the most hits on the most fish on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over any other type of steel leader. Now, Carl, he really likes that knotable steel leader. And what's unusual about that, Carl, is you just tie a knot in it like you would your line, right?
You could tie a line knot. You could tie any kind of knot with it. I mean, I've even tied an FG knot with this stuff. It's pretty good. I mean, it's not
coated.
You've
actually tied an FG knot with the steel?
Yep.
Really?
Last year, tarpon fishing.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
But here's another little piece. You can tie those line-to-line knots right to the wire, too, single strand. Albright Special right to it. I do it all the time.
All right. So you got an Albright Special with the single strand steel leader. Carl's using the AFW Knottable Steel Leader, which kind of to me is one of the best ones. Is a uni knot. Now you're saying the FG knot.
I usually use the uni knot, uni, but I have tied the FG with it. But it's very good stuff. I mean, you tie any type of knot with it, it'll hold up, and it's actually has a little bit of play to it too, so it's not so stiff.
Yeah.
Now, I've never understood with that piano wire, when you tie a line-to-line knot to it, you're putting a pretty hardcore kink in it. How is it that that doesn't pop?
Well, you're literally not pulling back on the kink because the knot is holding that closed, and it's actually pulling on the strand itself.
Okay. I just wasn't sure how that worked.
Yeah, that'd still be a good one to put on the
still like a pinch point
on the website to do a little.
Perplex me.
Yeah.
Because I think that's where you could tie, you know, like you said, an Albright knot to it or something like that. Or
yeah, it's as easy as it sounds, really is.
Yeah.
And okay. it just works. We've caught sailfish, big tunas, you know, lots
of
dolphins.
I know a lot of guys that do use it. I just have never understood how that single strand just doesn't pop on it.
It's one of my favorite things to do for black tips when we're using, you know, live baits or casting little pieces on small spinning rods. Just Albright, about 18 inches out on her because they jump so much.
Right. I'd like to practice that just to play with it to learn it.
All right. Carl, if you're going to take out a couple lures, some of these new lures, like Savage has got that cool little trolling bait. I like that one a lot. I like mixing different stuff. You guys kind of think about a different lure, but the one I'm going to go with, one I really like to troll with, is the Billy Bait. And Billy Baits were a phenomenon in the Keys because of their design and because of their skirts. But they also had dissimilar metals in them. And when pulled through the water, you would get a kind of electromagnetic field, in the water. And it's because of two different metals being pulled through salt water. That created kind of a static electric charge, magnetic field, something. But it got the fish's attention, and they caught more fish consistently than any other lure for a long time. Now, is there something special that you like to use, Carl?
I mean, one of my favorite, you know, all-time favorite trolling lures is the Bomber, the Long A.
Yep.
I mean, I've trolled this for tarpon, snook, kingfish,
tuna.
Tuna. I mean, just about everything. You know, very good hooks. I tend to go with the two hook one instead of the three hook. You know, more of a safety thing.
Gotcha. I'll second that one.
But I like the pink color.
Now, is there kind of a favorite all arounder you got, Morris?
Since we're talking about all trolling, I'll talk about, you know, where I tend to spend most of my time trolling out in the deep, deep water. And I would recommend black and purple, some type of soft trolling lure. We've caught every fish imaginable on the black and purple.
You kind of like those dolphin getter stuff. It's got a soft squid head on it. You got feathers coming out of the back of it.
The hard baits are great, but usually when a fish hits it, he knows right away. And a lot of the billfish species, they'll come up and bill something. And if it's hard, he usually won't go on it again. He'll go away and go to another bait. But
so what he's going to do is literally tap it with his nose.
A soft bait feels like a real thing, and he'll woof it.
And so he's actually testing to see, do I actually want to bite this when he hits it with his nose?
Well, he's trying to stun it because it's running away from him. So he comes up and tries to stun it. And that's why the outriggers have to drop back, you know, release clips and things like that.
Okay.
Why is it important for that?
Well, when they come up, most of the fish will do that. They'll try to stun the bait, especially if it's got a bill. Mm-hmm. They'll come up and stun the bait, and then they'll catch the stun bait and swallow it.
So when it pops off, like you run it from the end of your fishing rod down to the hull of the boat, you put a clip on it there.
Yeah, there's a clip in it.
Then the fish hits, it pops it out of that
and
clip.
Gives them that release, that slack line.
So it's kind of drifting like it's wounded and much more likely for that fish to come up and grab it. It's not so much to take the pressure off the hit from the rod, but actually to give it, say, 6-7 foot of just, okay, I'm floating here stunned, eat me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the reason most people don't really catch sailfish when they get one to bite, because, you know, as soon as that thing bites, you know, he'll sometime he'll get pointed by the hook or something like that, and he'll come up and jump and throw the hook, and that happens all the time. But if you're paying attention and literally targeting them, when that thing comes up on your bait, you're standing there with their reel and free spool, and when he bites it, you just let him have it for 5-6 seconds, reel tight on him, and you've got a hooked up fish, because that's how they eat things. They don't just woof them down.
Well, and it's the same way with kingfish and wahoo too. They'll come up, they're a slash and then eat kind of predator, so they'll actually usually hit the tail section of a bait,
eat that, and then come back for
cut
the rest.
It off, and then they circle back around to look for the wounded fluttering down bait. So a lot of guys that are doing that, when they see a hit, they'll dump it into free spool,
yeah,
let that bait go backwards just like the outrigger, and then the fish comes back and takes the rest of it out.
Pretty much all those fish are more successful if you've got a little drop back when that fish hits.
All right, let's jump over to walleye for a second.
Oh, walleyes, eh?
If, don't you know, we're going to talk about the major thing, the walleye. Okay, we get out there on the lake, we're trolling along, don't you know, and we get out there. Now, to me, the biggest difference would be that I'm going to go as slow as I can go.
Bounce the Lindy rig over the rock bed with the night crawler and the eerie deary.
You know, that's the one lure I can't get to work down here is an eerie deary. I pulled that eerie deary all over the place, put minnows on it, put worms on it, you know, white bait. I did everything I could. I gave up on it. I'm not going to bring an eerie deary back to Florida again. Any other lure, I'm all in. All the different Rapalas, the Mans, the you know, the inline spinners, the Meps, all that, Mr. Twisters, they all work great here. Pick a lure, it works here. Not a darn eerie deery. But trolling for walleye, to me, the biggest difference is, A, sometimes the size of the baits. Most of the time when I'm walleye fishing, I'm using some pretty small lures. I mean, I'll get up to 4, 4.5 inches, maybe around there, but I'm usually not going much over that. So it's fairly small stuff compared to what I like to troll here on the most part, you know, down to the little tiny twisters. And I mean, there's some of the stuff that's absolutely tiny. But to me, most of the time, now I haven't trolled in the Great Lakes since the zebra mussel phenomenon with the clear water. When I was trolling in the Great Lakes, we would put 5-gallon buckets out behind the boat to slow it down. Get it to go slower. If we're doing, you know, a mile and a half an hour, and that's as slow as the boat would go, we're putting buckets over trying to get down to a half a mile an hour.
Yeah.
And to me, that was really the major difference, because I kind of do a spread when I'm trolling saltwater, or freshwater rather, for walleye. I've got lures down deep. I've got lures up. I'm looking to see where they are in the water column. I'm not taking for granted they're near the surface or down deep. I'm just kind of putting lures everywhere. And what's your biggest difference between walleye trolling and, say, what we're doing here in the Gulf?
Well, one thing that really stood out to me when you were saying that was, if you put a 5-gallon bucket behind the boat and pull it here, you're liable to get a bite on that bucket.
Well, that's possible. The weirdest part about it is that's probably true.
Right.
I mean, there's something down there, a shark, something dumb enough, a Goliath grouper. If you were pulling a 5-gallon buck along, a Goliath grouper, a shark, something's going to come along and try and taste test it.
Oh, I'm sure.
A guy that used to be a fellow charter captain back in the 80s, and he insisted on painting he loved downriggers. He was from the Great Lakes, and he insisted on painting his downrigger balls fluorescent day glow orange.
Oh, that's like grouper candy.
Yeah, but he was trolling around out about 120 feet with me out there. And he called me on the radio, and he said, "We just got a massive bite." I said, "Well, what was it?" He said, "I don't know. It took my outrigger ball." He said it pulled the line, the cable, all the way to the end and snapped his cable. It almost broke his outrigger out of the gunwale. And didn't have a hook in it. So it was something that grabbed it and wanted it really bad.
Grabbed it, held it in his mouth, that big lead ball. Those are 10, 15 pounds of lead.
I think he was using a 10-pound ball.
Okay.
That's pretty cool.
He said he thought it was coming up to jump, too, by the way. He said the wire was coming up when it got to the end and snapped, and it never jumped.
Yes?
Who knows? Something that jumps.
I couldn't even imagine what it could swallow a 10-pound lead weight.
Well, I had some folks asked me one day at Stump Pass in about 92, 93. They came in and they had a couple blackfin tunas. The guy looks at me and he says, "Do we have swordfish out here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, we had three blackfin tunas on, three of these tunas." They didn't even know what they were. "We had three of these tunas on. We caught two. The other one we had on, this big blue and purple and silver fish ate it and took off jumping across the top of the water like it was skipping a stone." I said, "How big was it?" He said, "It looked like 8 to 10 feet long." I said, "It was a blue marlin." They were in 90 feet of water.
Wow. Okay. All right, but I'm going to fall back to walleye one last time.
Oh, the walleye.
Now, have you been up there since the zebra mussel thing?
I have.
It's been a few years since I've been up there. The zebra mussel phenomenon, which was going to end the Great Lakes. This was the death of the Great Lakes because it's an invasive species. Everything's going to die. And, yeah, and we're all, you know, the oceans have flooded up. They're all 50 feet higher than they were 3 years ago. Yeah, we're actually underwater here now. You know, it's impossible to live because that's what they told us 20 years ago. We're going to be 50 feet underwater here. So anyway, since the zebra mussel phenomenon and the water is so clear, is it still going real slow for the walleye?
You know, that the walleyes aren't speed feeders. They're not into chasing down something that's going really fast. Most of the things they eat are actually, you know, slow. You know, they're a crayfish, alewife, you know, small minnows. They love crawlers. Like we were joking about, bounce just as slow as possible along rock beds and reefs and things like that. And that the zebra mussel phenomena has just made the Great Lakes literally explode with fishing opportunities. I mean, there are massive brown trout, salmon now are at their best. Smallmouth fishing, the smallmouth bass have taken off now that, you know, people are just going up in that area just to catch hundreds of smallmouths. So, yeah, zebra mussels were actually okay.
A great thing to happen to the Great Lakes.
And I think they should have some barnacles like us anyway.
Yeah, you know. It's just kind of funny that whenever a non-native species shows up, according to the environmentalists, it's always the end of the world, like Oscars in the Everglades. They were the death of the Everglades. The Oscars were invading the Everglades. They're taking over. It's such a horrible thing. Came the number one tourist thing. People love eating them. The other fish, because they've got Oscar to prey on, there were so many of the baby Oscars, they actually started doing better because they actually had food for the first time in years.
We routinely catch 50, 60 bass while we're Oscar fishing and catching over 100 in a day. You'll have a bycatch of, you know, 30, 40, 50 bass, largemouth, which they're, you know, were supposed to be gloom and doom, but now, no, they're flourishing right along with the Oscar.
Well, sometimes it's like in the, down here now, we've got Mayan cichlids and we've got all these other things in our area, and everybody's screaming gloom and doom. The only one that I cannot figure out any real benefit for is that armored catfish. It destroys the banks, and it's really a bad fish. But pretty much every other one they've told us was bad actually turned out to be pretty good.
Yeah.
So I really got, you know, okay, yep, I'm going to believe another environmentalist.
Well, you know, the red snapper are endangered and all the other fish, the trigger fish are, and so are the amberjacks.
Now, Robert, you got a look on your face like...
Well, I mean, they end up finding their little niche on most of this invasive species. You know, the only benefit that I can say, like the armored catfish has had, is that it does provide a pretty good food source when you have some pretty heavy flooding out of the rivers for snook and tarpon.
You know, snook absolutely love them.
They love them.
And even redfish do eat them. You know, so there's pros and cons to them, but honestly, realistically, I mean, we've messed up this earth so much that who's to say what's going to be a benefit, because we've taken some of these other animals out of the equation in their good numbers. Something is going to fill in that niche one way or another.
I'm going to go with that. Yeah. I can use it. Pow! I'm about to have it with these ants. Brand new studio, and all of a sudden it's got ants in it, so now we got to spray everything again. Robert sprayed it. It's way better than it was, but we got more spraying to do.
Yep.
No problem. Yeah. It's either that or I'm going to be borrowing some toys, and there's going to be lots of holes in the wall. Let's see. not sure where I'm at with my notes. I kind of got lost in there. Oh, mackerel rigs. Now, they sell rigs that specifically for trolling mackerel. They usually have a treble hook and then a single hook back behind it. Quite often, there's a skirt in front of it. You know which ones I'm talking about, Carl?
No, I don't.
The Sea Striker ones, they're right by the freezers.
You've got a little duster and a spoon behind it, right?
Yeah, you can have a duster in the front and then maybe even a spoon, but there's a treble hook and then there's a single hook. Now, Morris, you would know what that's for. Anybody want to guess outside of Morris why there's a treble hook and then a single hook?
To hold the bait on easier, so it just, as it's going through the water.
Well, actually, a light is usually a single hook and then a treble hook.
I wasn't going to call you on that.
That's okay. You could have, Morris. I was waiting. I'm thinking, okay, somebody's going to call me on this because I know Robert knows the rig. I'm certain Morris knows it. This is not one. Carl fishes a lot in the Gulf, but he's not big on trolling in the Gulf. He's a big bottom fisherman. We did a show on bottom fishing, and he's in there every, you know, 10 seconds, giving answers, talking about stuff. He's been pretty quiet on this one, but that's okay. That's why there's four of us. We a little broader range of stuff. But with the single hook in the front, now, to me, that goes through the lip, right, Morris?
Nostril.
Through the nostril.
Yeah, okay. If you hook a fish that you troll, a live fish, if you hook them through the mouth or through the lips and you're trying to troll them, basically you're pinning his mouth shut.
That's what I thought I needed to do.
No, you don't want to pin his mouth shut because he's alive. You want him to breathe.
Okay, I was thinking dead bait. But for live bait, you want to put it through the nostril.
Traditionally, that rig is for live bait, slow trolling.
Gotcha.
Now, if you're going to pull a dead bait, like a cigar, frozen cigar minnow or a ballyhoo or something, or you know, sardine on that, then you would pin those lips together with the single hook.
So if the bait's dead, you pin the lips together, keep the water from filling that up, and making him go all erratic. If he's alive, you put him through the nostrils so he can stay alive.
Correct.
All right, because once you close his mouth, he can't breathe anymore.
Yes.
Okay, so the treble hook on the back.
That's a stinger rig. It should just be allowed to hang free because when you're slow trolling that, or even if you're fast trolling it, it naturally positions itself on the fish without hooking into the fish. And if you put that hook back into the fish, then the fish doesn't swim properly if he's alive. And if he's dead, it'll cause him to start going around in a slow circle.
All right. Now, I'm usually taking the treble hook, put one side of the treble. I leave a pretty good belly in the leader and then just put the one side of the treble hook into the fish. And now, I learned early on not to pull it tight and put it in, which is what I started out doing. Mm-hmm. And then I got a lot of bad reactions to the bait. But by leaving the kind of a loop in it, so to speak, a belly where it's not tight, I haven't had too much problems with the rolling.
Right. Now, on a live bait, when you do that, you'll also get cut off at the tail with that, whereas, you know, that little bit of loop that you're leaving in it, if you'll let that just hang free, it doesn't hang out to the side or down or up or anything. If you just put your bait in the water and pull that along at your trolling speed, which is usually pretty slow, you'll see that little treble hook just nicely go right up on the side of your bait right there in position.
All right, because I know a lot of people use rubber bands to put that treble hook up against the tail of a fish.
You could do that. It does it on its own.
Okay.
Now, and that makes sense. I've seen so many of those rigs where they got the single hook and then two sets of treble hooks.
Oh, that's for a bigger bait.
It's just for a bigger bait, but you'd still let it hang freely off the side.
Yes, it would.
Water pull it up to the side.
Because, like it or not, when you impale a fish other than like a big blue runner or something like that, or a big mullet, when you impale him with that hook, you're stopping the natural way he swims. So, in other words, say you put it in a dorsal. That's like when we're bass fishing. A lot of people say, well, hook that shiner behind the dorsal fin. Well, you just put a hook all the way through both of his major muscles, swimming muscle groups. So, in essence, what you've done is made that shiner ineffective unless he gets hit immediately because he won't last long. So, what we're trying to do with a live bait, and I did this, I fished the King Mackerel circuit for quite a few years and won quite a few tournaments with the exact rig we're talking about, and never did I attach a treble to the body of the fish for that reason. And we caught a lot of big fish.
Well, Okay. Anyway. Oh. This is Fish and Frank here in the chair. I got Robert in the chair across from me. We got Captain Morris Campbell in the guest seat. We got Captain Carl Buttigieg in the chair. Anyway, guys, we really appreciate you listening. Anybody got to want to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
All right. Today was a little bit about trolling. Next week, we're coming back with all kinds of cool new stuff. Email me at frank@fishandfranks.com if you have any kind of ideas for the show. Bye-bye.